Gonzalez, Mr. Gambino.
Good morning, Judge Posner, Judge Bauer, and Judge Wood. We're here today on behalf of Mr. Robledo Gonzalez, whose fundamental right to due process was violated in his deportation proceeding. And as a result of that, that deportation was allowed to be used to prosecute him criminally for illegal reentry. There are three issues before the court today. The first one is that we brought a motion before the district court to dismiss the indictment based on the Supreme Court's holdings in Mendoza-Lopez, which found that if a person is denied the right or not informed of his right to appeal to a judicial body from a negative decision in his deportation hearing, then the process is fundamentally flawed. And not only...
Well, what if there were no good ground for appeal? Then it would be harmless, right?
If there were no good ground for appeal, then presumably, yes, it would be harmless. In this case, what happened was not only was Mr. Robledo denied that information, but in the deportation hearing itself, the immigration judge relied on information that was incorrect, which was not corrected by his attorney or by the government, in order to deny him his initial petition for relief. And then, although he was he appealed to the Board of Immigration Appeals, he was not informed of his right to appeal to a judicial body. And in fact, at the time of his appeal to the Board of Immigration, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act had been enacted along with the IRA-IRA Act, which precluded him from judicial relief, or apparently did, although this court subsequently in 1998 said that that provision of the act could not be interpreted so narrowly to prohibit judicial review. So not only was it dismissed, his appeal dismissed summarily based on the Soriano decision, which in effect retroactively applied the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act to Mr. Robledo Gonzalez, which it was not permitted to do, even under this court's ruling at the time. It barred him from seeking judicial relief. And he did, in this case, have a plausible ground for relief, because as the court found in St. Cyr, the relief under Section 212C was routinely granted at the time that Mr. Robledo Gonzalez was going through his deportation hearings. And the fact that he was not allowed to have his appeal heard on its merits was certainly of great prejudice to him, because it resulted in him, in effect, complying with the deportation order that was entered against him and made it impossible for him now to get the relief that Mr. St. Cyr was allowed to get. So not only was Mr. Robledo Gonzalez in a position to get relief, he was denied that relief. And that.
And what relief was he in a position to get?
The Section 212C relief from deportation, which allowed people who were permanent residents, who had an established residency of 7 years or more, even if they had an aggravated felony conviction, which he did, but for which they had not served more than 5 years, to seek relief if they had strong family ties in the country and they had could show residence and involvement in business and several other basic factors, all of which applied in Mr. Robledo Gonzalez's case. He'd been here since he was a young man. He'd been a permanent resident for quite a long time. He had a child here at that time. Now he has three children who are citizens, and his wife was a permanent resident.
Okay, but the immigration judge considered those factors, didn't he?
Well, the problem with, yes, he did consider those factors.
So what would be the basis for a judicial overruling of that?
Because he relied on an incorrect representation of Mr. Robledo Gonzalez's criminal history in order to tip the balance against him in the first instance, because he believed that Mr. Robledo Gonzalez had two aggravated felonies. In fact, he had only one, and the other conviction did not rise to the level of an aggravated felony. And certainly, that had some effect on him deciding that his criminal history should outweigh his permanent
Why,
residence.
Why did the ALJ say that?
He was not, he referred to the two convictions as aggravated felonies, yes, and he did say that he didn't believe Mr. Robledo Gonzalez was entitled to the 212C relief. Now, a person...
One would do it, wouldn't it?
Pardon me?
One would do it, wouldn't it?
No, one would not do it in that sense. Certainly a person is deportable and was at that time based uh-huh. on having an aggravated felony conviction.
Right.
But they were also entitled to seek this 212C relief.
I know, but the one is enough, isn't it?
It would be enough for a judge to determine he didn't think that the equities balanced.
Yeah.
But I think that it, in most cases at that time, as pointed out by the court in St. Cyr, even when a person had one aggravated felony, if they had established family and community ties here, they were routinely granted the 212C relief.
Mm.
And that is a pretty critical factor for Mr. Robledo Gonzalez. And the fact that
is it just a question of classification? Did the immigration judge know what the second offense was?
Yes, he knew what the second offense was, but it was there were two drug offenses. One was possession with intent to distribute, which was the aggravated felony. The other was represented to him also as possession with intent to distribute, but it was not. In fact, the court records were incorrect. They had not changed the court computer records to accord with what actually happened in court. Mr. Robledo Gonzalez was convicted of simple possession, which at that time was not.
Well, did the immigration judge know what the quantity was involved in that second offense, the simple possession offense?
I don't believe they discussed quantities. I don't know. But certainly, a person presented before the immigration judge who had two aggravated felonies looks like a much greater risk for granting of relief than a person who has only one. And as a matter of due process, a person is entitled to have reliable information presented to the immigration judge, and this did not happen with respect to Mr. Robledo Gonzalez. That error was compounded by the Board of Immigration Appeals summarily rejecting his appeal based on the Soriano decision, which was interpreting the Anti-Terrorism and Death Penalty Act to be retroactive in effect. In addition, apart from the errors of due process that occurred in the deportation context,
could he have been deported on the basis of the simple possession charge?
He could have been, but the equities would be even more in his favor with respect to getting the relief that he sought.
Because he had two deportable drug offenses, and so one is classified as an aggravated felony and the other isn't, but they're both considered serious drug offenses.
Well, serious drug offense at that time was somewhat a term of art which referred to trafficking as opposed to simple possession.
But you said the simple possession would itself have been a basis for deportation.
Yes, it certainly is a factor for deportation. It was not automatic in the same way that an aggravated felony was, but any criminal offense under certain circumstances can be a basis for deportation. But a person standing before the immigration judge who has a number of equitable factors in his favor certainly looks different in the balance if he has two aggravated felonies as opposed to one fairly minor conviction and one aggravated felony. And so that, since that could have been the factor that militated against him, I see I'm about out of time. I'd like to reserve the rest for.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Convino. Mr. Young?
Good morning. May it please the court, Rick Young on behalf of the United States. In order to collaterally attack a prior deportation proceeding, the defendant must show that some defect in that proceeding effectively foreclosed him from seeking judicial review. There is no evidence in the record which indicates the defendant in this case was effectively foreclosed from seeking judicial review. This is not the case, like the Mendoza-Lopez case, in which an alien was rushed through a deportation proceeding and whisked out of the country within a matter of days without counsel, nor is it the case in which a group of aliens was brought before an immigration judge and induced to waive their right to appeal. The defendant's immigration proceedings in this case took place over a matter of years. They were initiated in 1993 and did not conclude until he voluntarily self-deported from the United States in May of 1997. And during most of that time, he had the assistance of counsel, a retained attorney, an attorney who represented him at all the key stages of the immigration proceedings. This attorney represented him at the immigration hearing. This attorney represented him in his appeal before the Board of Immigration Appeals, and this attorney represented him in the administrative matters leading up to his decision to self-deport. There is nothing in the record which suggests he was effectively foreclosed from seeking judicial review. To the contrary, the record suggests that he decided to forego his right to seek judicial review because he found there was a more expedient means of achieving his desire of remaining in the United States, namely leaving the country and illegally reentering. After agreeing to self-deport in May of 1997, he returned to the United States illegally only a month later. He eventually worked his way back up to Chicago and resided here until he was arrested in connection with this matter. It was defendant's decision to leave the United States to self-deport in 1997 that effectively foreclosed him from seeking judicial review. There was no procedural error on the part of the Immigration and Naturalization Service that so foreclosed him. Now, the defendant contends that he was not informed of his appeal right. That's simply not correct. He was informed. The immigration judge did inform him of his appeal right. At the conclusion of the hearing in which the judge declined to exercise discretionary relief, he informed the defendant that he had the right to seek an appeal before the Board of Immigration Appeals. Defendant and his counsel certainly understood this right. They reserved the right to appeal and ultimately filed appeal before the Board of Immigration Appeals. There was simply no requirement for the immigration judge to inform the defendant of anything more. There was no statute or regulation that required the immigration judge to inform the defendant that he may be ultimately entitled to direct judicial review or form of habeas review. Lastly, defendant not only had the opportunity to seek judicial review, he certainly ultimately obtained that review. After criminal charges were filed in this matter, he filed a petition for habeas corpus before the district court and ultimately appealed that decision, the decision dismissing that petition, to this court. Thus, he's not only had an opportunity to seek judicial review, he received the very review of which he now claims to be deprived of. For that reason alone, the fact that he was never effectively foreclosed from seeking judicial review, his attempt to collaterally attack his prior deportation proceeding must fail. However, even assuming this court were to find that he was effectively precluded, he would still be required to show that the proceedings were fundamentally unfair. Once again, in this regard, the defendant has failed to make such a showing. He contends that the proceedings were fundamentally unfair because the immigration judge relied on inaccurate information, which indicated that he had been convicted of two aggravated felonies, when in fact he'd only been convicted of one. There is no dispute that he was convicted of that one aggravated felony, and that was for possession with intent to distribute a controlled substance. There's also no dispute that that one felony was sufficient to render him deportable, and in fact created a rebuttable or a conclusive presumption that he was deportable.
Well, but nobody's arguing. I mean, that's not what Ms. Gambino's argument is. We sometimes, even in sentencing guidelines cases, say, you know, if you thought that it was, you know, a certain situation and that turns out to be an error, we don't know how it would have affected the exercise of discretion, so we'll send it back and we let the district court judge take another look at it, and I understand that to be her argument. We know how he exercised his discretion when he thought it was two aggravated felonies. We don't know whether he would have exercised his discretion the same way if it was one simple possession plus one possession with intent to distribute. And so we're being asked to make the assumption it would have been the same instead of find out.
However, the defendant in this case has a burden of showing prejudice. This court has held in a situation where an alien had been convicted of an aggravated felony and wasn't informed of his appeal rights, that defendant could not meet that burden because of the presumptions that arise from an aggravated felony. I think it's also noteworthy in this case that although the second conviction wasn't... I'm sorry.
I just was trying to remember whether that would mean, of course, now an aggravated felony disables you from getting these kinds of discretionary relief. So, of course, there would be no prejudice in today's world. But for the pre-IERA world, there would be, wouldn't there? Potentially.
Well, I don't think that defendant can show that there was because of the aggravated felony. And also, if you look at the nature of the second conviction, although it wasn't an aggravated felony, it was a possession count. And I think Ms. Gambino indicated she wasn't aware that the judge had discussed the amount. In fact, he did. The second conviction involved an amount ranging between 100 grams and 400 grams of cocaine. So although it wasn't an aggravated felony, it was nonetheless a drug felony, and it involved a higher amount than the first drug felony. I believe the amount involved in the initial possession with intent to distribute conviction was only 27 grams, and the court took note of that. Certainly, she can't show that he was prejudiced by that. I would also note that with respect to the St. Cyr decision, she contends that he was deprived of judicial review because of the application of the it was fundamentally unfair because he was deprived of the opportunity to seek relief by the 1996 amendment. First of all, I would note that there is no due process entitlement to discretionary relief under Section 212. Moreover, even if there were, he was not deprived of that right. He received a hearing before an immigration judge. That judge considered his application, held a hearing, allowed the defendant to testify, and ultimately made a decision that he explained both orally and in writing. The defendant received his due process with respect to discretionary relief. Although the Board of Immigration Appeals did not review that decision on the merits, he had no due process right to an administrative appeal. Due process entitles you to notice and a right to be heard, and he was heard, and the immigration judge denied his claim. For those reasons, the defendant cannot show that he was effectively foreclosed from judicial review, and even if he could, he cannot show that the proceedings were fundamentally unfair. For those reasons, the government would ask that the court affirm the conviction and sentencing of the defendant. And if the court has no further questions.
Okay, thank you. Just as a matter of idle curiosity, your list on the brief is a special assistant U.S. attorney?
That's correct.
Why are you special rather than ordinary?
Well, there's many reasons, but no. I'm an employee of the Social Security Administration on a detailed U.S. attorney's office.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Young.
Thank
you. So, Ms. Gambino, how much time does she have? 1 minute?
First of all, Mr. Robledo-Gonzalez was effectively foreclosed. Mendoza-Lopez was very specific that the right to notice has to go
to. But isn't Mr. Young correct that given the nature of the second felony, I don't mean second in order, but the possession felony, it's unlikely that the immigration judge would have changed his mind or that we would have reversed. It's possible. It's just unlikely.
I believe at that time it was not unlikely, as pointed out very clearly by the court in St. Cyr. At that time, 212C relief was nearly routinely granted, and I think that it was a significant issue.
But that doesn't really help you, because it may have been routinely granted, but this immigration judge, you know, swimming against the tide, turned him down. And if you told the immigration judge, well, yes, it was 100 to 400 grand, is that correct, as Mr. Young said?
I don't know if that's precise. That may have been what the charge was, but the problem is that they relied on the certified copies of conviction, which were not accurate, and there were more than one count. So I don't know if he's exactly right with respect to that. And it does make a difference, because even with one, the routine granting of 212C did go to one aggravated felony. I think the case that there were two incorrect sentences.
Yeah, okay,
sentences.
We've been through that. Okay, well, okay. Thank you, Mr. Okay, next case for argument today.